This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nathan Englander, has a new collection of short stories called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. His subjects are often dark, but his tone is often comic. He writes about tensions between Orthodox and secular Jews, the aftermath of the Holocaust, and conflicts about the future of Israel. Some of the stories are drawn from Englander's life. He was raised in a Jewish Orthodox family, neighborhood, and school. When he was a young man, he moved to Israel for a few years, and there he quickly gave up on organized religion. So you may find it surprising, as he kind of does, that he spent the past 2 years doing a new translation of the traditional Jewish book, the Haggadah, which tells the story of the exodus of Jews from Egypt. It's read at the Seder table during Passover. The new translation, called New American Haggadah, was edited by writer Jonathan Safran Foer and will be published next month. Nathan Englander, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start with a reading from the title story of your new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Do you want to set it up or do you want to just start reading?
That's funny. Anytime I set it up, I get metaphysical. It takes about 67 minutes. I just did an event. I did an event with Nora Ephron at Symphony Space a couple of weeks ago, and she set up the story, and I started talking about, like, dreaming of writing and identity issues, and I went on for about 19 minutes, and then she just looked at the audience, and she's like, it's about a book tour. So, yes. So I don't think you want me to set up anything at all, especially if it's the start of a story, except to say this one is, you know, it's the title story of the book, and it is very terrifyingly to me, but the commitment I made in the story is I married it to Carver's very legendary story, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love.
Okay.
They're in our house maybe 10 minutes, and already Mark's lecturing us on the Israeli occupation. Mark and Lauren live in Jerusalem, and people from there think it gives them the right. Mark is looking all stoic and nodding his head. If we had what you have down here in South Florida, he says and trails off. Yup, he says, and he's nodding again. We'd have no troubles at all. You do have what we have, I tell him. All of it. Sun and palm trees, old Jews and oranges and the worst drivers around. At this point, I say, we've probably got more Israelis than you. Debbie, my wife, she puts a hand on my arm. Her signal that I'm taking a tone or interrupting someone's story, sharing something private, or making an inappropriate joke. That's my cue. And I'm surprised, considering how much I get it, that she ever lets go of my arm. Yes, you've got it all now, Mark says, even terrorists. I look to Lauren. She's the one my wife has the relationship with, the one who should take charge. But Lauren isn't going to give her husband any signal. She and Mark ran off to Israel 20 years ago and turned Hasidic, and neither of them will put a hand on the other in public. Not for this, not to put out a fire.
That's Nathan Englander reading the title story from his new collection, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. I can assure you I've heard that conversation many times.
That's funny.
Have you?
Yes. Yeah. I think that was actually, as someone who spent a lot of years living in Jerusalem, one of the great perks was that when you come back and you get into these Israel arguments in your American Jewish clan, you can really just silence them by saying, I live there. So we used it like a bludgeon. You know, when people would say, like, you know, I'm AIPAC, I'm this, move that, move the, you know, embassy needs to be there. The embassy should have a Starbucks and be on the Temple Mount, whatever. You know, people do that. You'd say, I live there. And that was how we kept everybody quiet.
Israel is one subject that I think a lot of Jewish people can talk about in their own family because there's such disagreement within families. About,
oh, my God. Yeah. You know. I mean, that's it. I was going to say, I just saw her last night, but I'm so close with my sister and we look like twins. We are the same person. We have the same personality and we disagree. It's super peaceful and everything's copacetic and we do not talk politics.
So another thing that happens in the story, in addition to the disagreements about Israel and about religion, the two couples, the Hasidic couple and the secular couple, play a game that is called the Righteous Gentile Game, or Who Will Hide Me? Will you describe the game?
I will describe it, and for the audience at home and in their cars and on their podcasts, I'm beet red with embarrassment as I explain this. It's so deeply personal, and it's not a game, and that's the point. I call it a game. It makes it easier to talk about it as a game, but it's something we play with dead seriousness in my family, and that is, you know, we would... With dead seriousness, we would, you know, wonder who would hide us in the Holocaust if there were a second Holocaust. And as and I think that's sort of the interest for me, you know, as a and again, I never know. We need to get anthropology. I don't know what to count myself as a fourth generation or fifth generation. I was just arguing about this. We've been in America a long time. You know what I'm saying? I have great grandparents born here. And that idea that my sister, because of her religious education, were raised in a sense, we have the minds of, you know, like survivors kids, you know, in the States, which is a very strange concept for such deeply, you know, we have no one with accents in our world. Anyway, we really were raised with this idea of a looming second Holocaust. And we would play this game, you know, that threat is always in the air. You know what I'm saying? People were comfortable in Berlin. It could happen at any time. And we would play this game, you know, wondering who would hide us. And this is this story, I've been carrying it in my head for 20 years ago. It must have been 20 years ago. But I remember my sister said about a couple we knew, she said, he would hide us and she would turn us in. And it struck me so deeply. And I put it on the neighbors in this story. But I just couldn't shake that thought for all these years because it's true. And yeah, so I guess, I don't know, for this book is, you know, everything, every book better be fully intimate. It better be all you have. I'm obviously not shy because I'm going to talk your ear off today, but I'm private, which is different. But that idea is for me to be truly intimate, for me to be naked and raw. The fiction allows me to do what I need to do emotionally. And with this book, I don't know, it was suddenly certain stories were looking at things. It was a chance for me to look at things that were right there. In a sense, this is totally, it's normality, this game. And I just took a step back and said, my God, we're pathological.
So the impression I'm getting is that, okay, you were brought up in Long Island in a prosperous suburban community, but you're brought up as if a new Holocaust is right around the corner, so start preparing because you're going to be marched off to a death camp unless you find a neighbor or a friend willing to risk their life to hide you. And it's such an embattled mentality, such a paranoid mentality to be carrying around in a prosperous Long Island suburb in what, the 1960s?
I was going to say, I'll make two corrections, which is not so prosperous, but, hanging on to middle class. But, you know, we didn't have FM radio on the car, but we did have AM. But also, yeah, the 70s and 80s. I'm born in 1970. I'm a disco kid by a month. But yes, the 70s and 80s. But you know what? I think it was this strange thing. I mean, it was, you know, I'm living back in Brooklyn and I was very resistant to doing that. You know, I live up the block from my dad's high school and my uncle went to school, you know, behind our building at Pratt. You know, it was all these Brooklyn dads and they made this exodus and, you know, a lot of them went to public school. They were religious, but that generation went to public schools, like they built these yeshivas and they spent, you know what I'm saying? That, you know, that's where prosperity comes in. It was this education that I so fought against and so rebelled against and worked so hard to leave was a huge, huge, you know, effort for my parents to give me that education. You know, it's just wildly expensive. But but the point is we had these old school rabbis. So I think that's why I write the way I do. I studied with Marilyn Robinson at Iowa. God bless her. She taught me many wonderful things. But one thing she taught me was that I was writing all my sentences in sort of transliterated Yiddish. So, you know, so, you know what I'm saying? My mom's, you know, Boston, you know, she's a Boston and my dad's from Brooklyn, but I hear everything, you know, I should wait all day here for you to show up 5 minutes late. You know what I'm saying? That's because we went to school. We got there at, you know, 8 in the morning and left at 5. You know, college was easy for us. We were in school a million hours a day with these sort of Brooklyn raised or old country rabbis yelling at us in that rhythm. And I feel like that's the rhythm in my head. So I basically receive these messages from the rabbis about what the world will do. My point is, as living as the Holocaust is for me, as an idea of something that just happened and can happen, I feel the same way about the Inquisition. You know what I'm saying? My heart, seriously, I think of the rabbi.
I'm laughing.
I was going to say, you are just have no empathy for the losses of the Inquisition. Obviously, you're a Mel Brooks fan. But
Let me just stop you here. So you're brought up with fear that the Holocaust can happen any second.
Yeah.
Maybe the Spanish Inquisition, in which all the Jews from Spain were expelled. changing the whole map of Jews around the world forever and ever. Okay,
yes.
So how did that affect the rest of your mentality? Did you grow up a worrier, paranoid? Did fear infiltrate other aspects of your life?
I think we can call it a day right now. I've just reached the very core of my soul. I thought it would be a longer interview. But yes, that is, I am constantly in a state of fear. So, yeah, you know what? I was going to say, it's just between us, so I might as well tell you everything. But but the point is, so this is what I'm getting as an education, is this education of, you know, fear and betrayal and Jewish history, which is not, you know, amplified. It just is. But my mother raised me very clearly that if you cross the street, you will die. If you go outside, you will die. If you play sports, you will likely die. So that's what I was getting at home. But, you know, my point is, I think it may have had a larger imprint on my soul. I don't think other people are worried about it as much. But that story, how we avenged the Blooms in the book, that is a war that we had with the anti-Semites of our town. You know what I'm saying? And those things, when you wear a yarmulke, that's the idea. It's you, you know, communing with God, this idea of making a symbol for yourself and for everyone of your relationship and your religion. But that idea of walking down that street, you know, I call it in the story, the chased home from schools. I mean, but those, you know, swastikas, I remember, you know, driving by with my dad and seeing, you know, red swastikas on the sign for, you know, the synagogue, or a shaving cream one on our door on Halloween. You know, those kind of fights and battles and curses. But that,
so,
we really had that escalated war with the anti-Semites in our town. It was insane.
So that actually reinforced all your fears.
Yes. I think, as long as I'm going to tilt this chair back and lay down and turn this into straight up therapy. But I think that's why Jerusalem was why I had to live there all those years. I mean, I've been endlessly tortured. My friends found it, you know, it was never not entertaining that I decided I was some, you know, lefty, atheistic hippie and then went off to live in Jerusalem for all those years. But there's a reason. You know what I'm saying? I was so, you know, think about my grandfather on my mother's side, who was reformed, like what it was for these like shtetl kids to show up at the house. You know, he loved us dearly, but I just even conceptually, with the yarmulke and the tzitzis and, you know, all this stuff, I spent my time, my childhood in America feeling Jewish and not American. And it's only in Israel, it was those years there where I finally got to be an American. You know, everybody's
okay.
A Jew.
I want you to do another reading.
Sure.
And this relates to what we're talking about. It's from the story How We Avenged the Blooms, which is about a family, two families, a group of people dealing with the neighbor anti-Semite.
Our parents were born and raised in Brooklyn. In Greenheath, they built us a Jewish Shangri-La, providing us with everything but the one crucial thing Brooklyn had offered. It wasn't stickball or kick the can. Acceptable losses, though nostalgia ran high. No, it was a quality that we were missing, a toughness. As a group of boys, 13 and 14, we grew healthy, we grew polite, but our parents thought us soft.
I think that's so interesting because obviously your parents were trying to protect you, and that's why they wanted to create this little Jewish Shangri-La in Long Island of people just like them.
Yeah.
You know, a kind of very insulated Orthodox community sent you to yeshiva. But then they think, well, you're soft. You're too protected. But they're the ones who protected you.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, two things. The thing I wanted to say about Jerusalem was that, you know, I lived there during this, I lived, you know, in the heart of the city during this unbelievably violent time. They once did a map of all the bombings, and I feel like within, you know, a 4-block radius or, you know, kilometer radius of my front door were just 90, I mean, the whole neighborhood was blowing up, and it was violent and terrible. But I think for me, I was like, it's so easy to die is how I lived my whole life. And then I finally understood it's also kind of hard to get dead. Like, my point is you can't control it's one way or the other. But for me, it was honestly a life-changing and head-changing discovery.
Tell me if I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly. I think you found it a relief to go from just this, like, vague paranoia about everything that maybe someday there's going to be another Holocaust and you'll be rounded up and that'll be the end and you'd better start worrying now, to going to Israel where there was a genuine threat and people carried on. And so you were facing something real and knew that you could survive in the face of it like everybody else did. You could just live your life.
God bless you. Yes, that was a huge, huge discovery for me. Also, by the way, if you're paranoid and you put yourself in a place of real existential threat, then you're not paranoid anymore. So it was also a huge relief for me on that front. It was like living in Catch 22. Like every time he goes up, you know, Sarian's up in the plane and he says, you know, they're trying to kill me. Yes, they are. So I think also that idea where I'm like that the state of panic, I didn't stick out in a crowd anymore. The cold sweat was just general.
So we established that you grew up very Orthodox and in a very like Jewish Orthodox community in Long Island, lived for a few years in Israel, where you became secular. Now, people would probably think it would be the other way around, that you'd go to Israel and become more religious because it is, after all, the Jewish state. So how is it that you ended up becoming secular in Israel?
You know, I've really been comparing it lately very gingerly but sincerely to friends' coming out stories. I think when you grow up in a world and your parents are one way and you're told this is your world, this is how the whole world is, and this is how you're supposed to be, and you are terribly unhappy in that world, it's a very scary thing. And that's, I don't even know why, that the whole time I was so religious and so sincere and so interested in the text, but just felt like this is not the world for me. And it grew and it grew. And I really, that's why I think it's almost that idea where just because one, you know, just because your father is religious and your mother is religious doesn't mean, you know, the same, that it's, you know, two heterosexual parents are going to make a heterosexual child. And for me, you know, I just thought I will be in this world and I will be unhappy. Because this is, you know, I'm a good kid. That's what I was supposed to do. I thought this is what I've been given and this is how it's going to be. And also, if you really love a certain thing, like I love texts and I love learning and I love, you know, a lot of stuff that goes with that life. And I think when I'd meet a Jew who was totally unaffiliated, you know, to me, we didn't, there was no such thing as being a cultural Jew. So that idea, I just didn't connect. I wouldn't meet someone who said, oh, yeah, I you know, my mom's Jewish, or, you know, yeah, I think, you know, we did Purim one year. Like, I didn't, there was no leap that I could make that I could connect and say, ah, this, here is a path, this is a world that I can connect with. And when I got to Israel and see these people, you know, living in Hebrew, living that life, to me, it was the first time I saw Jews who were so, you know, who had the biblical references, all this stuff, deeply secular, atheistic Jews who I could identify with. And I mean, the first week there is when I gave up organized religion. My first Shabbat in Israel is I broke it after, you know, 19 years.
So this was the first time you saw a community of Jews who weren't Orthodox?
Well, no, I went to, you know, I was going to say, for me growing up on Long Island, it was this idea. I mean, it was so wild and racy from my town that I even went away. I went to Binghamton, that I went away to state school. And for me, that was a world crack open because I met Jews from other parts of Long Island. To me, it was like being at the UN. It was crazy. You know, I loved it. I was just, that was wildly exciting. And then my real breakaway was to fly around the world and meet Jews from other countries. You know, it was just, that was my opening out.
Just giving new meaning to the word multicultural.
Yeah, exactly. I'm multi-monocultural.
So what did it feel like that first Sabbath when you did not observe the Sabbath?
It was, I remember what it was. It was taking a bus back from Tiberias. You know, certain buses can leave before the end of Shabbat. And I got on a bus with my friends before the end of Shabbat from Tiberias. You know, those, and I just... the experience was simply that I was sure that I had killed everybody on the bus, that God would have to throw that bus off a cliff and that it was my fault. So I was not only going to die, but I was killing the others, and I felt pretty bad about that.
And how did it feel when you didn't die on the Sabbath?
It felt like I wanted a cheeseburger.
Oh, mixing meat and dairy,
yes.
Which is not
yes.
Kosher. So did
no.
You break the kosher thing on?
I did. This was before a million or so Russians had come to Israel, and you could get, you know, pork at every, you know, that there were butchers around town. It was pretty hard to break that rule. I had to wait months to find a cheeseburger back at that time. But yeah, my buddy had flown to London. I literally got out at Victoria Station, my first trip to England, and went up the stairs into Burger King and had me a Whopper.
So when you gave up religion, you not just gave up Orthodox, you didn't just give up practicing Orthodox religion. I mean, you gave up religion, right? You gave up practicing the Jewish religion.
Yeah, it's funny, and I was going to say if we're gonna, it's going to get all embarrassing when we get to the Haggadah because, you know, now what have I done? But, you know, I always like to scream about politics. I don't know why, but it's just, it's like stretching a rubber band. You know, if you stretch a rubber band that tight, it's, you know, the energy has to go somewhere. So my point is you don't just, it's not a light giving up. I was literally going through the Bible. I think I was looking, you know, going to, you know, tear a limb off a living animal and eat it. I was trying to think of every rule that I could possibly break till I checked them all off. So, yeah, it was an active irreligiosity for a while because that's what a young person who's making a change is going to do is swing in the other direction. So it was very active for a while till you know, I was going to say it'd be like if I was on the, you know, now I'm 42 years old. If I was, you know, complaining to you about something that happened in high school, it's time to let it go. But then it was large and electric and active.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Nathan Englander. His collection of short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank, draws on his experiences growing up in an Orthodox Jewish family, neighborhood, and school in Long Island. As a young man, he moved to Israel, where he quickly gave up on organized religion. So it's kind of surprising that he spent the past 2 years doing a new translation of the traditional Jewish text, the Haggadah. His translation, called the New American Haggadah, was edited by his friend, the writer Jonathan Safran Foer, and will be published next month. I'll let Nathan Englander describe what the Haggadah is.
It's the story of Exodus, and every year on Passover, when the, you know, we all know the Red Sea getting split and the 10 plagues and all that stuff. It's, as Jonathan Foer, who is the editor of it, keeps saying, thinks it's, you know, probably the most popular story around. But yes, so it's a way to commemorate the Jews, you know, freedom from slavery.
And it's basically, you know, a book that is read during the Passover Seder, the dinner, or it's read
right
before the dinner. Dinner's very late.
Yeah, I was going to say it's the Jews like to eat. If your audience doesn't know that, and it is the dinner with the biggest buildup of the year, I have to say. But
and it's also so you have a new translation, and the book is called The New American Haggadah. It's about to be published.
Yes.
The editor is Jonathan Safran Foer, who I think initiated the project. You did the translation,
yes.
And I'm sure our listeners who heard the beginning of this interview were thinking, why did they choose this guy? This guy used to be Orthodox, then he became really secular. He rebelled against religion. So who is he to be translating a very important religious text? So why you?
I have to say and Jonathan's, you know, I've been working on the translation for 3 years. I think Jonathan's been working on this project for six. But I think it's just, I don't think anybody else could have talked me into it. He really sort of knows how my synapses fire. He's got a good read on my brain. But I thought it was a really bad choice on his part as well. You know, my point is, I've never translated before. I've left religion. Everything you've said, and you know, he just made it clear. He just had a vision for this book, and he really wanted me to translate it. And he just made it clear that it would be something that we'd really be proud of at the end. He was really adamant about that. And I have to say, it's informed my writing. It's changed the way I think, and having the book here, I'm really thankful for it. And it ended up being, I thought it'd be this hipster Haggadah and take me 6 weeks. I have been working on it for 3 years.
What language did you translate from?
Oh, well, this is the point. I thought also, you know, I speak Hebrew and I'm very familiar with this text. And, I, you know, so that's it. I had the religious education and then I lived in Israel for all those years. So I've got old Hebrew and I've got old Hebrew and new Hebrew. So, yeah, it's translated from the Hebrew and Aramaic. It's translated from primary sources.
And what was your ambition? What did you think needed changing? I mean, why do we need a new Haggadah?
We never need new Haggadahs, and there will be endless. It's sort of, I think, of all the traditional Jewish documents, it's the one that's most living. People, there's a Armed Forces Haggadah and an Alcoholics Anonymous Haggadah and an LGBT Haggadah. There are Haggadahs for everything. Some families make them new every year. People, it's a really wonderful living document. And, you know, even Jonathan's choice of the New American Haggadah, they're always of a place. A very legendary one is the Sarajevo Haggadah. They're just constantly made throughout time, and he felt it was time for a new one. But about what made the decision for me to translate it, it was really clear when I went back to think about it and look at texts. You know, I've always used the Hebrew side of the Maxwell House, which is a really great liturgy. That is a very traditional great liturgy. The point is, I'd never really looked at the English. And, you know, and what committed me to it is that Back to loving texts, which is the Haggadah, you should read it and weep. It is so beautiful. It is just such a moving document to me. And I looked at, I guess I'm always a naive, you know, back to living in Israel, it's when I think I understood that governments were run by actual people. I thought presidents and prime ministers knew more. There are these great moments. And I just didn't understand, oh my God, translators are people too. They're human beings. I just didn't understand that, even as someone who writes books, but about religious texts, you know, that people were making decisions. You're always making decision. And the line I can tell you is that really clinched it for me is in Hebrew, it says, you know, lavdil bein kodesh lekodesh. And in English, it was translated, which is what it means, to differentiate between the Sabbath and the holiday. But in Hebrew, what it says is, you know, to differentiate between holy and holy. And I was like, someone made this decision for clarity and understanding. It means between these 2 days. But to me, the poetry, the metaphysical space, the space between holy and holy, for that to not be there in the English was just, it made me understand that I wanted to do, you know, it turned it from this, what I thought would be a 6-week project, into me working with a study partner head to head. It's called Chavruta style, face to face. We studied, you know, I don't even want, my girlfriend says, we can't have a mezuzah on the door, but I have to come home to you with Talmuds and Haggadot piled to the ceiling arguing. You know, it was like living in a study hall for her.
But, so, yeah. I'd like you to choose a passage from the New American Haggadah, which you translated, a passage that you think is particularly beautiful.
Oh, sure. My pleasure.
And after you read it, maybe you could tell us what you changed and why you changed it from the translations that you were familiar with.
Super. This is from Nishmat Kol Chai, which is not just in the Haggadah, but it's considered a very beautiful Hebrew passage. And so give all credit to the original. Were our mouths filled with a singing like the sea, and our tongues awash with song as waves countless, and our lips lauding as the skies are wide, and our eyes illumined like the sun and the moon, and our hands spread out like the eagles of heaven, and our feet as fleet as fawns. Still, we would not suffice in thanking you, Lord God of us and God of our fathers, in blessing your name for even one of a thousand thousand from the thousands of thousands and the ten thousands of ten thousands of times you did good turns for our fathers and for us.
So in your translation, how different is it from ones that you knew?
I was going to say that, you know, there's maybe, first of all, I didn't know any, and that's the point. I literally, you know, it's just from the Hebrew. Like, that's it. I have no familiarity with translation except for, you know, during the project, you know, after it's finished, maybe looking to see it, other stuff. So, but it is. Sorry, I don't know why I'm stuttering through. It seems a strange thing to say. But yes, the English is simply unfamiliar to me.
Now, you use the term in your translation in referring to God, to King of the Cosmos. Now, I can't say that I remember hearing the word cosmos in any services or prayers. Or in the Bible. Not that I'd necessarily know.
Yeah.
But it seems to me an interesting choice. I think I've heard like King of the Universe, but cosmos? So tell us about using the word cosmos.
You are such a generous reader, as I know, both as a listener, but here I am. But thank you. You know what? It's been so long, it just becomes part of you, these projects, but I guess I hadn't thought about it. Those choices were the most wrestled over. You know, it's maybe that one, and also God of us for Eloheinu. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always our God. So it's this idea, I think, back to language, that things we don't hear anymore. You know, it's you know, something like friendly fire or something, these things that are very loaded and they have meaning and you know the meaning. That's how we get through life in a speedy fashion. You know, words have meanings and we already have them at the ready and we move through them. And I thought people say these things in English and I think they're forgetting what they're saying. And it means the world to me that you ask that question, because that's the point, you know, because you'd say universe, you read past it. But that's what it's saying, you know, of the cosmos, and it makes you think, and that's it. And that was really it. I think maybe the most dangerous choice in the whole book was God of us instead of our God. Because we say our God, it's not our God that we own, like our God, our TiVo, our lunchbox. You know what I'm saying? It's God, it's you know, it's the our God means the God over us. And I really thought about that a ton. And I think that's, you know, I'll see how people respond. But to me, I wanted people to be thinking about what they're saying. If you are, you know, a lot of people, that's the weirdest, you know, again, this choice of me doing it, but I could not take it seriously. And John, I thought we're going to be ironical and sassy, you know, sassy guys, you know, but the point is we ended up taking it so deeply seriously. And I, you know, and I just felt people are going to be, because I speak the Hebrew, I just always assume people have the same knowledge base as me. I suddenly thought, my God, people are going to be praying from this sincerely. And I owe, you know, I owe them a debt. I better think.
So why cosmos and not universe or all?
I was going to say we need a whiteboard or something. These I can't even tell you how many hours of arguing for things like that. But again, I think because it did make you think, A, and I think because to me, you know, just really looking at the Hebrew and thinking of what that word mean and just thinking it encompassed the cosmos. And also even that, the biggest point of translation is choice. Every word you're choosing, rhythm, clarity, communication, meaning, intent. And I think maybe, you know, even that one can be the feel of King of the Cosmos. Does it justice?
Now, one of the times you use King of the Cosmos, I'm going to do the larger reading there. It's like, you are blessed, Lord God of us, King of the Cosmos, God, our Father, our King, our Majesty, our Creator, our Redeemer, our Shepherd, Shepherd of Israel, the good King who makes good for all. You know, when you read something like that, when I read something like that, part of me wonders, does God need to be praised that much? Like, why is there so much praise for God? Is it just a kind of thanksgiving for life, thanksgiving for, you know, whatever it is, that animating force that yes. that we call God? Or is God like this egotist and we need to say, hey, man, you're number one. You are great. You are the God of all. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I was going to say, I'm going to answer that question for you now, but I'm sure you'll get a bunch of emails answering it for you. I guess this is the point of also, you know, of doing a translation of what you hear in Hebrew. Exactly that. It's not, that's the point of wanting to make it sound the way it sounds in my head, which to me is very beautiful, right? There can be over-cloying thanks. You know, that's what we, right? Nobody wants that. Nobody even enjoys it when they get it. It's often just acknowledging a power structure. I know what you're saying, where you're like, thank, you know, someone gives you a job. Oh, thank you. You saved my life. This is the, you know, it's over the top. And trust me, I'm an over the top thanker. So I know what you're, I know what you're saying. But I guess I find this, you know what? This is about freedom from slavery. This is about being redeemed. This is about getting your homeland that was, you know, promised you. This is about return. It's actually, it is a deeply sincere text. I think it is truly thanking God for the food that we are eating, for the freedom that we have, for the, you know, for the family around us. I you know what I can tell you? This is so personal and will, you know, probably make my family cry. But, you know, I remember my brother-in-law, as I said, I'm like fourth or fifth generation. And sitting there, my sister's husband, you know, his father's an Auschwitz survivor. And, you know, he, you know, sitting there with him, I remember one Seder with his family. I don't know if they'll remember it, but this is when we all became one family. But sitting there, this is also probably, you know, 15 years ago or more, you know, 15 or 20 years ago, but all of us sitting together and just seeing this guy, that's what makes it a living document. He sat there and he looked at the table and he started to cry and he said, I have been a slave. And I thought about it. I said, this man was in Auschwitz. I don't know if I've ever met. He literally had been a slave. And that freedom, there's a lot of thanks for survival and freedom that goes into that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Nathan Englander. He has a new collection of short stories called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. And he's also translated a new version of the Haggadah, which is the prayer book that's used on Passover during the Seder. The Haggadah tells the story of the exodus of the Jews from Egypt, a story that, if you don't know the Bible, maybe you know from the movie The Ten Commandments.
Which is awesome.
Do you like that movie?
Who does not love that movie? That and The Wizard of Oz, before, you know, for those of us, you know, didn't, you know, before TiVo and all that stuff, and on demand. Those were big watches for the year, were Ten Commandments and Wizard of Oz.
Which, they, I don't know if they still do, but they used to show it like every year on either Easter or Passover.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one of the most famous parts of that story is when God inflicts the 10 plagues on the Egyptians who have enslaved the Jews. So I would like to have you read some of that from your new translation, and then we'll talk about it.
With pleasure. Here are the 10 plagues. Everybody dip your fingers at home. Blood, frogs, lice, a maelstrom of beasts, pestilence, boils, and hail full of fire, locusts, a clouded darkness too thick to pass, the killing of the firstborn.
That's some scary stuff. Hail full of fire. Not just darkness, but a clotted darkness. That's C-L-O-T-T-E-D. So have you gone back to English translations? I should have brought one so I could compare it.
Oh, this I was going to say, you are would make an excellent rabbinical student. You sort of picked out, as I said, it's a hyper-literal translation. There were a few chances I took in this translation, and that was one of them, because I thought about this section is for adults, but it's also really for children. I think that's, you know, aside from, you know, hunting for the Afikoman, I think this is a huge, huge part of the Seder for children. And as Orthodox children, we were taught, we were not, you know, yes, you're saying them at the Seder, but you're taught this stuff in school and at shul. And the idea is, we were always told, yes, the hail came, but it wasn't just hail. It was a ball of ice with fire. It was fire and ice living together. There was a fiery center. Or when God made it dark, it wasn't dark. It was so thick that you couldn't even move. Everybody was, if you were walking in the street, you were frozen. And I thought, when I heard those words back to translation, if you're asking me to be translator, when I hear hail, that's what I see. When I hear darkness, that's what it means. And I decided to commit to that for the translation.
So are you saying this wasn't a literal translation? This was your understanding of it?
The whole translation is hyper-literal, and this one instance is what it literally means to me.
You are no longer an observant Jew. Will you have a Seder and use your own Haggadah this year?
Jonathan and I were joking about this. We're like, if we don't find our Haggadahs at the Seder, people are going to be in trouble. But at least our families can use them. But I have to say, of all the holidays, I really don't do anything. I really do go to, if I can get to my family, I get there. I've been going to a friend's the last few years. But yeah, I do the Seder every year. I was going to say, I don't know if I'm softening or finding comfort or some different. My point is, it's okay. It's okay to live in conflict with yourself. That's a nice thing that I've discovered. It's okay for me to be really secular. That's the idea. People can just, I'm trying to calm down. The point is, I really enjoy that holiday. And yes, I go to a Seder every year and I, drive there and keep a house full of bread and all that stuff. But I really do enjoy that meal and this book.
What were your Seders like as a child?
As you say that, it's really rare for me to have a brain that only records. I can never remember. I only retain negative memories. It helps with my worldview. But I literally can be like, people like, my girlfriend will be like, you were never happy in childhood. I'm like, not that I recall. When I see a picture of me smiling or my mother, I sort of can't remember being happy. But it's my grandparents' house was happy to me. And I think, I do remember the Seders. It's also the idea of the work behind, What I remember more, it's the switching of dishes. You have to switch your dishes. And this idea, the old country stuff that comes over, the dishes that survive, but it's getting, this boxes of china. We ate on Corningware like everybody else did then, good white plates that you could drop down the stairs and they'd bounce back up. But this idea, suddenly delicate plates would come up from the basement and these big sort of 1920s spoons. And I really remember the stuff of it and the switching of the house. I mean, it is such a huge deal getting the house ready. It's really obsessive, the hunt for, bread.
Well, Nathan Englander, thank you so much for talking with us.
This has been a great pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Nathan Englander's new American Haggadah will be published next month. His new collection of short stories is called What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air. Award-winning British writer Helen Simpson has said that her only rule for short story writing is that something's got to happen, but not too much. Her fifth collection, called In-Flight Entertainment, has just been published, and book critic Maureen Corrigan says that there is, in fact, a lot happening in Simpson's stories, but most of what's taking place is elegantly tucked under the surface.
The Brits, you've got to hand it to them. The empire may be long gone, but they still reign supreme when it comes to effortlessly exuding mordant wit. For anyone who savors the acerbic literary likes of Evelyn Waugh or the Amoses, father and son, Helen Simpson is just the ticket. Her latest short story collection, In Flight Entertainment, is filled with crisp observations about mortality, infidelity, and the looming apocalypse of climate change. Melancholy subjects, to be sure, and Simpson accords them their emotional weight. But one suspects that even as the ice caps melt, Simpson's hardy strain of Britwit might well be wheezing out a rueful quip or two. The title story, In Flight Entertainment, is alone worth the price of this book. In it, a businessman named Alan is riled because his flight to Chicago has been delayed by what he derisively calls Heathrow Nutters, environmentalists protesting airplane carbon emissions. He's somewhat mollified by being upgraded to first class, but just as he settles in to sip his champagne and watch the old Hitchcock movie, North by Northwest, the old guy across the aisle begins making quite a fuss. An announcement then goes out asking if there are any doctors on board. The brilliance of this story lies in the way Simpson compresses so many worlds into the tiny space of that first class section. Here's a snippet where Alan is ordering dessert from the flight attendant when he suddenly hears the whump of a defibrillator being used on the struggling man nearby. Alan realized the flight attendant had failed to take his pudding order. Now Cary Grant was climbing up Washington's granite nose. Pudding was the best part of the meal for him. He allowed himself to be distracted by the Mount Rushmore chase sequence for a few minutes, and the next time he looked up, he saw the doctor shaking his head and rolling down his sleeves. Did that mean? Apparently it did, because a tartan blanket was being pulled up over what must now be the corpse. That's only the start of the grousing in first class, as the plane is diverted to Goose Bay, Canada. We're all on the same one-way flight to the abyss, Simpson implies here, but many of us, like Alan, are so armored by luxury and our own self-regard that the warning sirens barely penetrate. Squirrel is another triumph of multiple points of view shrink-wrapped into a small space. A family of three gathers in a garden. The middle-aged mother, named Susan, suffers her teenage daughter's scorn and her husband's bullying. He's occupied trying to kill a squirrel. He's trapped under a dustbin lid. As daughter and father joke about Henry VIII and the various forms of torture appropriate for the furry prisoner, Susan keeps up an anxious internal monologue, wondering if her husband has caught on to her extramarital affair. Her fate and the cornered squirrels become drolly but movingly entwined. Sometimes Simpson herself wants to take a mental health break and flee from earthly concerns into the realm of fantasy. The Festival of the Immortals is a satirical piece about a literary festival featuring only those writers whose work is out of copyright. What that means under British law is dead. Superstar Shakespeare arrives by helicopter. George Eliot gets tetchy when she's misintroduced as the author of The Floss on the Mill. And Emily Bronte charms everyone with her frankness about the disease that finished her off in a roundtable discussion entitled TB and Me. All in good fun, but Simpson's range is best displayed in the more apocalyptically minded pieces here, like Geography Boy. It's a tale of two British college students in love cycling around France and arguing, sometimes pompously, about climate change and activism. The boy and the girl stop at a chateau to tour some famous medieval tapestries filled with ghastly images of the end of the world. In the final sentences of the story, the quarrelsome lovers call a truce and hold each other as they look up at the night sky. Simpson gives them and her readers the gift of a moment's elegiac reprieve. They stood in the fathomless dark, Simpson writes, and stared saucer-eyed beyond the stratosphere into the night as troops of boisterous planets wheeled across the blackness all round them.
Maureen Carrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Helen Simpson's latest short story collection called In Flight Entertainment. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. And you can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. Roberta Shurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.